Accession number 14284, Reel 4.
Mr. Carling, Reel 4. You're saying they were broad Yorkshire?
I got the impression that I was a prisoner of war. I had it firmly fixed in my mind that these people were speaking a foreign language. The way they were treating me was so brutal. I just couldn't believe that it was just an ordinary English hospital, you see. And I suppose it must have been some months before I was sedated properly so that my wife could come and visit me. And her first visit brought me immediately back to earth. I looked up more or less from sleeping and saw her, there she is, standing by my bed. And I said, "What the hell are you doing here?" And she said, "Well, you're sick. I've come to visit you." "God," I said, "I thought I was in Stalag." And from that moment on, of course, I was on my way to recovery. I had 9 months off work, I might tell you.
It sounds as though the worry of being a prisoner of war was preying on your mind then.
Yeah. I had a distinct revulsion for the idea of being taken prisoner. I think that came from having taken so many prisoners in Libya. You know, we collected 80,000 Italians in the first rush of victory. And what those chaps were going through was nobody's business.
In what way?
Well, first off, their own people were strafing us when we were loaded with prisoners of war in the back of the trucks. So I had an awful lot of people killed by their own folks. In fact, I put up in black with the Red Cross. One of their officers reported me for leaving the dead behind because he reckoned there was no way of certifying whether people were dead or not. But I had no time to make sure about things like that with enemy fighters attacking the vehicles all the time. I think that very largely was one of the things. I'd seen what prisoners of war suffered, and I was determined it wasn't going to happen to me.
What about the sight of men being killed and wounded in the war? Do you think that had a bad effect on you?
I suppose one of the things you have to say is this. At the beginning of the war, before the war started, before I joined the forces, I was working for the people's dispensaries for sick animals. When people were evacuated, I was in London, you see, when people were evacuated from London, they had to have their animals destroyed. And from doing a job which I considered to be, you know, kindness to animals kind of job, I suddenly find myself shooting, well, at one point 100 dogs in a day and destroying, well, hundreds and hundreds of cats. That makes you sort of bloodthirsty, or cold-blooded, you might say, is the right word, isn't it?
Hardened.
It hardens you to the idea of death in another, and possibly in yourself as well, I suppose.
So you think that hardened you for what was to come in the war?
I think very largely, although, of course, I didn't realize it until the slaughter began, shall we say, like that. You know, and until you saw some people killed, and behaved in that sort of cold manner, you didn't realize just what had, trained you for the ordeal.
Do you have any VE Day memories? Do you have any memories of what happened to you on VE Day?
What kind of a booze up we had, you mean?
Anything at all. Does it stick out in your mind as an occasion?
Not really. Not really. I didn't believe it. You know, VE didn't mean anything, really, because our people were lining up to go to Burma. We were about to deal with the Japanese. I was in the slot for discharge, but they'd given us numbers. I'm not quite sure what they called it again, but it was like being in a
hyphen.
That's the thing. So it was a toss-up whether VE Day meant I was going to be moved quickly out, or whether VE Day meant we were going to change our field of operations and valuable people like us were going to be needed.
So it didn't really sink in with you?
It didn't really sink in. I was, more or less ready to go to Japan. I'd like to add something, since you asked about how the war ended and what I remember most about it. I was posted to Finnmear to await my discharge on what we just remembered, the Python thing, when the remains of Commander Keyes were brought back to the UK. He had been killed in Tunisia, I believe it was.
North Africa.
In a raid, a commando raid on Rommel's headquarters, I think it was. And we were called upon to form a guard of honour over his remains when they were lying in the family chapel, the chapel of the family house, which was quite near where we were stationed. 12 of us did the all-night vigil. Four at a time, one on each corner of the dais. We were relieved each hour and stood with reversed arms and paying our respects in this beautiful, quiet little chapel. The spiritual effect of that has left a permanent memory with me. It was absolutely fabulous.
Where was this?
A place called Finnmear.
Which part of the country is that?
Emma.
Where?
We'll look it up in we'll look it up in the AA book.
I gather you come from the northeast of England.
I'm a Geordie from South Shields.
What did your father do for a living?
At the end of the war, he was collecting waste oil from the destroyers, which were coming into dry dock, and taking it out to the people who were manufacturing crude lubricants for the mines. I took that business over.
In 45?
After
the Second World War?
Yeah, in 52 when my father died. he had been doing this right through the war. When the war finished, we got the contract from the whale factories, the Southern Harvester and the Southern Venturer, which came into dry dock on the Tyne. What every summer, because our summer was the Southern Ocean winter. So we had the two big whale ships, two big whale factories, come in, and got all the waste oil out of their engine rooms and storage spaces, and there was a market for it, of course. And my father had the equipment to collect it and transport to deliver it to the various places where it could be made use of.
Did you have, in the war, any connection with an organisation called ABCA, the Army Bureau of Current Affairs?
I didn't myself, but my wife attended one of their courses, and she found it very interesting indeed. Aldous Huxley was one of the principals of the place where she attended. Of course, her headquarters were in London. Her billet was in Sloane Square at the time. And she took a general sort of course, and I'm not quite sure of the subjects she covered, to tell you the truth. And, of course, when she was eventually discharged, she just chucked the army up altogether. She didn't want to go. She didn't want to go on with it at all. In fact, when she came home, she'd actually given her uniform away.
The reason I ask is because they always say that ABCA had such an influence on the election of a Labour government in 1945.
Yes. it is possible that my wife's interest in ABCA ceased as soon as she realised that they were a socialist organisation. My wife's background has been conservative for, on both sides of her family, for several generations in the North. And there is a very distinct borderline between the conservatives and the others on Tyneside. On Tyneside, you can take it from me, all socialists are communists, or they're labelled red. And this reds under the bed thing started, I imagine, in Bladen or Wickham or somewhere like that.
Do you remember anything about the election of 1945 as a serviceman?
I do. I was shattered at the time because, although I wasn't politically oriented in any way, and I suppose as a young man I had had very sort of socialistic ideas in the way that a church reared, shall we call it, a church reared type, would regard the Christian way of life as being very closely associated with basic socialist theories. I hadn't reached the point, I might tell you, where I had decided that socialism wouldn't work, although I think quite late in the war I read Bernard Shaw's comments about socialism being more or less an impossible ideal. And I tended to agree with that because, well, I had been approached at one point, and I'm not quite sure where it was, to join the Shop Assistants Union. And I took one look at the man who suggested that I should join the Shop Assistants Union, and the little bell in my head rang and said, here's a racketeer for you, if ever there was one. Obviously, his main interest was simply collecting whatever it was, fourpence a week, for the funds at that time. I don't think they had any great ambitions, the trade unions, to become part of the political scene at the very beginning. At that time, it was very much a kind of, another insurance book, wasn't it? You know, in those days. At one point, I'd had an insurance book and collected, you know, sixpence a week for funeral expenses. And got to know quite a lot about the ins and outs of the insurance agent's hardships.
Why do you think that the servicemen tended to vote Labour in the 45 election?
I don't think the servicemen actually did vote Labour. Because in my own experience, and I witnessed this happening, there were elements in the services who were politically inclined. There were very strong elements in the services who had communist ideas. You can imagine how easy it is for a man who doesn't like being pushed around, for a man who's had to stand up and take it from the sergeant major, from the sergeant, from the corporal, from the lancejack. He's had to jump to it whenever he's been told to do so. He absolutely hates authority of any kind by the time he's due to come out of the army. He doesn't want to be a conservative. He wants to join in with the people who are going to run the world more or less by the masses. you know, for the people would be taking over. The people. Well, what a lot of rot.
But you were saying that you didn't think that the servicemen did vote Labour.
They didn't. The scheme to include serving personnel in the electoral rolls involved sending out postal votes to every station in the forces. Army, Navy and Air Force, everybody had a slip saying, send your vote back to such and such a place, you know, where they were on the electoral roll. Most of the lads just looked at it, and like all the other circulars, they just more or less chucked them in the bin, you know. I don't think anybody was particularly interested in voting. Certainly in our unit, there was no real interest in voting. We were expecting to have to go to Burma or somewhere like that to fight the Japs. And it wasn't going to worry us which government was in here. In fact, most of us had agreed very heartily with the arrangement which was going on during the war when we had a coalition government. You had chaps like Attlee who were good types, but really had just a share in the running of the show and had to knuckle under to the, what shall I say, the main influence himself, you know. Churchill ran everything politically because the war was the only important subject that there was to be dealt with.
So why did Labour get all these votes then?
Because in, I would say, every unit, there was the odd type who got the idea, all you have to do is pick these slips up and send them back with socialist, a cross against a socialist candidate. I certainly saw a chap, and I think his name was Douglas, and I can't remember, and I was rather surprised because I hadn't ever looked upon as him as a political type. In fact, I hadn't really looked upon him as one of the really intelligent blokes in the unit. But he came in and asked two or three chaps, you know, have you sent your voting slip away? And all the chaps in the hut immediately said, oh, we aren't bothering, you know, we aren't going to bother about that. And he said, well, will you give them to me? Will you give them to me? And they all said, yes, yes, you can have them. Nobody was interested which way he was going to vote. Nobody had thought about it or studied it. Nobody had really put their brains in steep about the political implications of having a continuation of the socialist government. Nobody had really looked back to what happened after the 1418, when we fell into the hands of, what's his name, MacDonald, wasn't it? You know?
Ramsay MacDonald.
Ramsay MacDonald. And, well, the trade union officials who sprouted around him and became landowners and directors of every prosperous organization, and eventually led to this damn silly nationalization business, which has almost wrecked us, simply because the people who got the jobs because they knew somebody, not because they knew something, you know?
So what did Douglas do with the slaves?
He sent them off to his own working men's club type of organization, who sorted them into the various postal districts. They'd collected hundreds, they'd collected thousands through the working men's club organization, I imagine, but or through some such organization which had very strong socialist influence.
So they could freely dispose of the vote as they wished?
Absolutely, yes. As long as you had the slip with the man's name and his number on an electoral roll, all you had to do was to put a signature of sorts on it. They were forgeries, but nobody checked as far back as that, did they? I don't think anybody was ever asked, did you really vote for John Smith, you know?
Did you do this? Did you let him have your own slip?
Yeah, I wasn't interested in politics at all. I didn't care a damn who was in government.
So he got your slip as well?
I imagine so.
Can we go back much earlier to when you were 2 years old? Because you got a First World War incident. I don't know if you remember it, but maybe you've been told what happened to you.
I must admit, I haven't got a clear memory of it, although I have a clear memory of actually seeing a Zeppelin. Even as a two-year-old, I suppose, one is a bit surprised at the sight of something flying in the air for the first time. A couple of incidents like that. But the one with the Zeppelin is very firmly impressed on my memory, because there had been a warning and everybody had been told, get indoors, get under the table, you know, in case, because this particular airship had just bombed West Hartlepool, and news had reached the Tyne that she was making her way on a northerly course and could possibly intend to bomb Newcastle or some nearby town to the place where we were in South Shields. However, I had slipped away and instead of going indoors was wandering about in the street and saw this thing coming over. I didn't really have time to take it all in, but the impression is firmly on my mind that it was a Zeppelin flying at 400 or 500 feet, I suppose, And my mother came screaming out into the road and picked me up and ran indoors and got very upset and gave me a jolly good twanking for not coming indoors when I was told. That puts me down as one of the first casualties of the 1418, I suppose.
Everybody had been ordered indoors?
Everybody had been told, look out, he's liable to bomb us, you see. The police had been around. They didn't have loudspeakers in those days, but there was a policeman more or less on every street corner in those days. And word was passed on very quickly in wartime, because the main communication for the government was through the police force in those days. The police were very much, for instance, interested in espionage, you know? More or less every police station had a section looking out for spies. And the police were able to warn us that this particular airship was making its way northwards and could possibly be making for the Tyne.
Any memories of the men who returned from Dunkirk?
Let me tell you another story before that. At about the same time as the airship incident, our house was in between the drill hall for the Northumberland Hussars and the area where they used to do the exercises, which was the Dragon Field near the coast, you know. And they used to come up our street with their limbers, horse-drawn limbers, preparing to be sent off to France, of course. And on this particular day, I stood and watched the troops going by, which was quite a sight to see, you know, mounted men galloping up the road with a limber. And everybody cheered when they'd gone by. And I took off my bonnet at the time, and I'm waving my bonnet around and threw it in the air, and the wind caught it and blew it over the wall, which took it onto the railway line of the Hart and Coal Company, which was an electric railway, one of the first, I suppose. And nobody ever dared go near to find my bonnet again. My mother was terribly upset, I might tell you. That got me a jolly good twanking, too. But yes, about Dunkirk.